that girl whom I never saw, save dappled with the shadows of their leaves, was to me herself a plant of local growth, only taller than the rest, and one whose structure would enable me to approach more closely than in them to the intimate savour of the land from which she had sprung. I could believe this all the more readily, and also that the caresses by which she would bring that savour to my senses were themselves of a particular kind, yielding a pleasure which I could never derive from any but herself, since I was still, and must for long remain, in that period of life when one has not yet separated the fact of this sensual pleasure from the various women in whose company one has tasted it, when one has not reduced it to a general idea which makes one regard them thenceforward as the variable instruments of a pleasure that is always the same. Indeed, that pleasure does not exist, isolated and formulated in the consciousness, as the ultimate object with which one seeks a woman's company, or as the cause of the uneasiness which, in anticipation, one then feels. Hardly even does one think of oneself, but only how to escape from oneself. Obscurely awaited, imminent and concealed, it rouses to such a paroxysm at the moment when at last it makes itself felt, those other pleasures which we find in the tender glance, in the kiss of her who is by our side, that it seems to us more than anything else a sort of transport of gratitude for the kindness of heart of our companion, and for her touching predilection of ourselves, which we measure by the benefits, by the happiness that she showers upon us. Alas, it was in vain that I implored the dungeon keep of Roussainville, that I begged it to send out to meet me some daughter of its village, appealing to it as to the sole confidant to whom I had disclosed my earliest desire, when, from the top floor of our house at Combray, from the little room that smelt of orris root, I had peered out and seen nothing but its tower, framed in the square of the half-opened window, while, with the heroic scruples of a traveller setting forth for unknown climes, or of a desperate wretch hesitating on the verge of self-destruction, faint with emotion, I explored across the bounds of my own experience an untrodden path, which, I believed, might lead me to my death, even until passion spent itself and left me shuddering among the sprays of flowering currant which, creeping in through the window, tumbled all about my body. In vain I called upon it now. In vain I compressed the whole landscape into my field of vision, draining it with an exhaustive gaze which sought to extract from it a female creature. I might go alone as far as the porch of Saint-André-des-Champs. Never did I find there the girl whom I should inevitably have met had I been with my grandfather, and so unable to engage her in conversation. I would fix my eyes, without limit of time, upon the trunk of a distant tree from behind which she must appear and spring towards me. My closest scrutiny left the horizon barren as before. Night was falling. Without any hope now would I concentrate my attention, as though to force up out of it the creatures which it must conceal, upon that sterile soil, that stale and outworn land. And it was no longer in lightness of heart, but with sullen anger that I aimed blows at the trees of Roussainville Wood, from among which no more living creatures made their appearance than if they had been trees painted on the stretched canvas background of a panorama, when, unable to resign myself to having to return home without having held in my arms the woman I so greatly desired, I was yet obliged to retrace my steps towards Combray, and to admit to myself that the chance of her appearing in my path grew smaller every moment. And if she had appeared, would I have dared to speak to her? I felt that she would have regarded me as mad, for I no longer thought of those desires which came to me on my walks, but were never realized, as being shared by others, or as having any existence apart from myself. They seemed nothing more now than the purely subjective, impotent, illusory creatures of my temperament. They were in no way connected now with nature, with the world of real things, which from now onwards lost all its charm and significance, and meant no more to my life than a purely conventional framework, just as the action of a novel is framed in the railway carriage on a seat of which a traveller is reading it to pass the time. And it is perhaps from another impression which I received at Montjouvain, some years later, an impression which at that time was without meaning, that there arose long afterwards my idea of that cruel side of human passion called sadism. We shall see in due course that for quite another reason the memory of this impression was to play an important part in my life. It was during a spell of very hot weather. My parents, who had been obliged to go away for the whole day, had told me that I might stay out as late as I pleased. And having gone as far as the Montjouvain pond, where I enjoyed seeing again the reflection of the tiled roof of the hut, I had lain down in the shade and gone to sleep among the bushes on the steep slope that rose up behind the house, just where I had waited for my parents years before, one day when they had gone to call on Monsieur Vinteuil. It was almost dark when I awoke, and I wished to rise and go away, but I saw Mademoiselle Vinteuil, or thought at least that I recognised her, for I had not seen her often at Combray, and then only when she was still a child, whereas she was now growing into a young woman, who probably had just come in, standing in front of me, and only a few feet away from me, in that room in which her father had entertained mine, and which she had now made into a little sitting-room for herself. The window was partly open. The lamp was lighted. I could watch her every movement without her being able to see me. But, had I gone away, I must have made a rustling sound among the bushes. She would have heard me, and might have thought that I had been hiding there in order to spy upon her. She was in deep mourning, for her father had but lately died. We had not gone to see her. My mother had not cared to go, on account of that virtue which alone in her fixed any bounds to her benevolence, namely, modesty. But she pitied the girl from the depths of her heart. My mother had not forgotten the sad end of Monsieur Vinteuil's life, his complete absorption, first in having to play both mother and nursery maid to his daughter, and later in the suffering which she had caused him. She could see the tortured expression which was never absent from the old man's face in those terrible last years. She knew that he had definitely abandoned the task of transcribing in fair copies the whole of his later work, the poor little pieces we imagined of an old music master, a retired village organist, which we assumed were of little or no value in themselves, though we did not despise them, because they were of such great value to him, and had been the chief motive of his life before he sacrificed them to his daughter. Pieces which, being mostly not even written down, but recorded only in his memory, while the rest were scribbled on loose sheets of paper and quite illegible, must now remain unknown for ever. My mother thought also of that other and still more cruel renunciation to which Monsieur Vinteuil had been driven, that of seeing the girl happily settled with an honest and respectable future. When she called to mind all this utter and crushing misery that had come upon my aunt's old music master, she was moved to very real grief, and shuddered to think of that other grief, so different in its bitterness, which Mademoiselle Vinteuil must now be feeling, tinged with remorse at having virtually killed her father. "Poor Monsieur Vinteuil," my mother would say, "he lived for his daughter, and now he has died for her, without getting his reward. Will he get it now, I wonder, and in what form? It can only come to him from her." At the far end of Mademoiselle Vinteuil's sitting-room, on the mantelpiece, stood a small photograph of her father, which she went briskly to fetch, just as the sound of carriage wheels was heard from the road outside, then flung herself down on a sofa and drew close beside her a little table on which she placed the photograph. Just as, long ago, Monsieur Vinteuil had placed beside him the piece of music which he would have liked to play over to my parents. And then her friend came in. Mademoiselle Vinteuil greeted her without rising, clasping her hands behind her head, and drew her body to one side of the sofa as though to make room. But no sooner had she done this than she appeared to feel that she was perhaps suggesting a particular position to her friend, with an emphasis which might well be regarded as importunate. She thought that her friend would prefer, no doubt, to sit down at some distance from her upon a chair. She felt that she had been indiscreet. Her sensitive heart took fright. Stretching herself out again over the whole of the sofa, she closed her eyes and began to yawn, so as to indicate that it was a desire to sleep, and that alone, which had made her lie down there. Despite the rude and hectoring familiarity with which she treated her companion, I could recognize in her the obsequious and reticent advances, the abrupt scruples and restraints which had characterized her father. Presently she rose and came to the window, where she pretended to be trying to close the shutters and not succeeding. "Leave them open," said her friend. "I'm hot."
"But it's too dreadful. People will see us," Mademoiselle Vinteuil answered.
And then she guessed, probably, that her friend would think that she had uttered these words simply in order to provoke a reply in certain other words, which she seemed indeed to wish to hear spoken, but from prudence would let her friend be the first to speak. And so, although I could not see her face clearly enough, I am sure that the expression must have appeared on it which my grandmother had once found so delightful, when she hastily went on,
"When I say see us, I mean, of course, see us reading. It's so dreadful to think that in every trivial little thing you do, someone may be overlooking you."
With the instinctive generosity of her nature, a courtesy beyond her control, she refrained from uttering the studied words which, she had felt, were indispensable for the full realization of her desire. And perpetually in the depths of her being, a shy and suppliant maiden would kneel before that other element, the old campaigner, battered but triumphant, would intercede with him and oblige him to retire.
"Oh, yes, it is so extremely likely that people are looking at us at this time of night in this densely populated district," said her friend with bitter irony. "And what if they are?" she went on, feeling bound to annotate with a malicious yet affectionate wink these words which she was repeating out of good nature, like a lesson prepared beforehand, which she knew it would please Mademoiselle Vinteuil to hear. "And what if they are? All the better that they should see us."
Mademoiselle Vinteuil shuddered and rose to her feet. In her sensitive and scrupulous heart, she was ignorant what words ought to flow spontaneously from her lips so as to produce the scene for which her eager senses clamoured. She reached out as far as she could across the limitations of her true character to find the language appropriate to a vicious young woman such as she longed to be thought. But the words which she imagined such a young woman might have uttered with sincerity sounded unreal in her own mouth. And what little she allowed herself to say was said in a strained tone, in which her ingrained timidity paralyzed her tendency to freedom and audacity of speech, while she kept on interrupting herself with,
"You're sure you aren't cold? You aren't too hot? You don't want to sit and read by yourself? Your ladyship's thoughts seem to be rather warm this evening," she concluded, doubtless repeating a phrase which she had heard used on some earlier occasion by her friend.
In the V-shaped opening of her crepe bodice, Mademoiselle Vinteuil felt the sting of her friend's sudden kiss. She gave a little scream and ran away, and then they began to chase one another about the room, scrambling over the furniture, their wide sleeves fluttering like wings, clucking and crowing like a pair of amorous fowls. At last, Mademoiselle Vinteuil fell down exhausted upon the sofa, where she was screened from me by the stooping body of her friend. But the latter now had her back turned to the little table on which the old music master's portrait had been arranged. Mademoiselle Vinteuil realized that her friend would not see it unless her attention were drawn to it, and so exclaimed, as if she herself had just noticed it for the first time, "Oh, there's my father's picture looking at us. I can't think who could have put it there. I'm sure I've told them 20 times that is not the proper place for it." I remembered the words that Monsieur Vinteuil had used to my parents in apologizing for an obtrusive sheet of music. This photograph was, of course, in common use in their ritual observances. Was subjected to daily profanation, for the friend replied in words which were evidently a liturgical response. "Let him stay there. He can't trouble us any longer. Do you think he'd start whining? Do you think he'd pack you out of the house if he could see you now with the window open, the ugly old monkey?" To which Mademoiselle Vinteuil replied, "Oh, please," a gentle reproach which testified to the genuine goodness of her nature. Not that it was prompted by any resentment at hearing her father spoken of in this fashion, for that was evidently a feeling which she had trained herself by a long course of sophistries to keep in close subjection at such moments, but rather because it was the bridle which, so as to avoid all appearance of egotism, she herself used to curb the gratification which her friend was attempting to procure for her. It may well have been, too, that the smiling moderation with which she faced and answered these blasphemies, that this tender and hypocritical rebuke appeared to her frank and generous nature as a particularly shameful and seductive form of that criminal attitude towards life which she was endeavouring to adopt. But she could not resist the attraction of being treated with affection by a woman who had just shown herself so implacable towards the defenceless dead. She sprang on to the knees of her friend, and held out a chaste brow to be kissed, precisely as a daughter would have done to her mother, feeling with exquisite joy that they would thus, between them, inflict the last turn of the screw of cruelty in robbing Monsieur Vinteuil, as though they were actually rifling his tomb of the sacred rites of fatherhood. Her friend took the girl's head in her hands and placed a kiss on her brow with a docility prompted by the real affection she had for Mademoiselle Vinteuil, as well as by the desire to bring what distraction she could into the dull and melancholy life of an orphan. "Do you know what I should like to do to that old horror?" she said, taking up the photograph. She murmured in Mademoiselle Vinteuil's ear something that I could not distinguish.
"Oh, you would never dare!"
"Not dare to spit on it? On that?" shouted the friend with deliberate brutality.
I heard no more, for Mademoiselle Vinteuil, who now seemed weary, awkward, preoccupied, sincere and rather sad, came back to the window and drew the shutters close. But I knew now what was the reward that Monsieur Vinteuil, in return for all the suffering that he had endured in his lifetime on account of his daughter, had received from her after his death. And yet I have since reflected that if Monsieur Vinteuil had been able to be present at this scene, he might still, and in spite of everything, have continued to believe in his daughter's soundness of heart, and that he might even, in so doing, have been not altogether wrong. It was true that in all Mademoiselle Vinteuil's actions the appearance of evil was so strong and so consistent that it would have been hard to find it exhibited in such completeness, save in what is nowadays called a sadist. It is behind the footlights of a Paris theatre, and not under the homely lamp of an actual country house, that one expects to see a girl leading her friend on to spit upon the portrait of a father who has lived and died for nothing and no one but herself. And when we find in real life a desire for melodramatic effect, it is generally the sadic instinct that is responsible for it. It is possible that without being in the least inclined towards sadism, a girl might have shown the same outrageous cruelty as Mademoiselle Vinteuil in desecrating the memory and defying the wishes of her dead father, but she would not have given them deliberate expression in an act so crude in its symbolism, so lacking in subtlety. The criminal element in her behaviour would have been less evident to other people, and even to herself, since she would not have admitted to herself that she was doing wrong. But appearances apart, in Mademoiselle Vinteuil's soul, at least in the earlier stages, the evil element was probably not unmixed. A sadist of her kind is an artist in evil, which a wholly wicked person could not be, for in that case the evil would not have been external, it would have seemed quite natural to her, and would not even have been distinguishable from herself. And as for virtue, respect for the dead, filial obedience, since she would never have practiced the cult of these things, she would take no impious delight in their profanation. Sadists of Mademoiselle Vinteuil's sort are creatures so purely sentimental, so virtuous by nature, that even sensual pleasure appears to them as something bad, a privilege reserved for the wicked. And when they allow themselves for a moment to enjoy it, they endeavour to impersonate, to assume all the outward appearance of wicked people, for themselves and their partners in guilt, so as to gain the momentary illusion of having escaped beyond the control of their own gentle and scrupulous natures into the inhuman world of pleasure. And I could understand how she must have longed for such an escape when I realized that it was impossible for her to effect it. At the moment when she wished to be thought the very antithesis of her father, what she at once suggested to me were the mannerisms in thought and speech of the poor old music master. Indeed, his photograph was nothing. What she really desecrated, what she corrupted into ministering to her pleasures, but what remained between them and her, and prevented her from any direct enjoyment of them, was the likeness between her face and his mother's blue eyes, which he had handed down to her, like some trinket to be kept in the family, those little friendly movements and inclinations which set up between the viciousness of Mademoiselle Vinteuil and herself a phraseology, a mentality not designed for vice, which made her regard it as not in any way different from the numberless little social duties and courtesies to which she must devote herself every day. It was not evil that gave her the idea of pleasure that seemed to her attractive. It was pleasure, rather, that seemed evil. And as every time that she indulged in it, pleasure came to her attended by evil thoughts, such as ordinarily had no place in her virtuous mind, she came at length to see in pleasure itself something diabolical, to identify it with evil. Perhaps Mademoiselle Vinteuil felt that at heart her friend was not altogether bad, not really sincere when she gave vent to those blasphemous utterances. At any rate, she had the pleasure of receiving those kisses on her brow, those smiles, those glances, all feigned, perhaps, but akin in their base and vicious mode of expression to those which would have been discernible on the face of a creature formed not out of kindness and long-suffering, but out of self-indulgence and cruelty. She was able to delude herself for a moment into believing that she was indeed amusing herself in the way in which, with so unnatural an accomplice, a girl might amuse herself who really did experience that savage antipathy towards her father's memory. Perhaps she would not have thought of wickedness as a state so rare, so abnormal, so exotic, one which it was so refreshing to visit, had she been able to distinguish in herself, as in all her fellow men and women, that indifference to the sufferings which they cause, which, whatever names else be given it, is the one true, terrible, and lasting form of cruelty. If the Méséglise way was so easy, it was a very different matter when we took the Guermantes way, for that meant a long walk, and we must make sure first of the weather. When we seemed to have entered upon a spell of fine days, when Françoise, in desperation that not a drop was falling upon the poor crops, gazing up at the sky and seeing there only a little white cloud floating here and there upon its calm, azure surface, groaned aloud and exclaimed, "You'd say they were nothing more nor less than a lot of dogfish swimming about and sticking up their snouts. Ah, they never think of making it rain a little for the poor labourers. And then when the corn is all ripe, down it will come, rattling all over the place, and think no more of where it's fallen than if it was on the sea." When my father's appeals to the gardener had met with the same encouraging answer several times in succession, then someone would say at dinner, "Tomorrow, if the weather holds, we might go the Guermantes way." And off we would set, immediately after luncheon, through the little garden gate which dropped us into the Rue des Perchamps, narrow and bent at a sharp angle, dotted with grass plots over which two or three wasps would spend the day botanizing, a street as quaint as its name, from which its odd characteristics and its personality were, I felt, derived. A street for which one might search in vain through the Combray of today, for the public school now rises upon its site. But in my dreams of Combray, like those architects, pupils of Viollet-le-Duc, who, fancying that they can detect beneath a Renaissance rude loft and an 18th-century altar traces of a Norman choir, restore the whole church to the state in which it probably was in the 12th century, I leave not a stone of the modern edifice standing. I pierce through it and restore the Rue des Perchamps. And for such reconstruction, memory furnishes me with more detailed guidance than is generally at the disposal of restorers. The pictures which it has preserved, perhaps the last surviving in the world today, and soon to follow the rest into oblivion, of what Combray looked like in my childhood's days, pictures which, simply because it was the old Combray that traced their outlines upon my mind before it vanished, are as moving, if I may compare a humble landscape with those glorious works, reproductions of which my grandmother was so fond of bestowing on me, as those old engravings of the Cenacolo, or that painting by Gentile Bellini, in which one sees, in a state in which they no longer exist, the masterpiece of Leonardo and the portico of St. Mark's. We would pass in the Rue de l'Oiseau, before the old hostelry of the Oiseau Flesh, into whose great courtyard once upon a time would rumble the coaches of the Duchesse de Montpensier, de Guermantes, and de Montmorency, when they had to come down to Combray for some litigation with their farmers, or to receive homage from them. We would come at length to the Mall, among whose treetops I could distinguish the steeple of Saint-Hilaire, and I should have liked to be able to sit down and spend the whole day there, reading and listening to the bells, for it was so charming there, and so quiet, that when the hour struck, you would have said not that it broke in upon the calm of the day, but that it relieved the day of its superfluity, and that the steeple, with the indolent, painstaking exactitude of a person who has nothing else to do, had simply, in order to squeeze out and let fall the few golden drops which had slowly and naturally accumulated in the hot sunlight, pressed at a given moment the distended surface of the silence. The great charm of the Guermantes way was that we had beside us, almost all the time, the course of the Vivonne. We crossed it first, 10 minutes after leaving the house, by a footbridge called the Pont Vieux. And every year, when we arrived at Combray on Easter morning after the sermon, if the weather was fine, I would run there to see, amid all the disorder that prevails on the morning of a great festival, the gorgeous preparations for which make the everyday household utensils that they have not contrived to banish seem more sordid than ever. The river flowing past, sky blue already between banks still black and bare. Its only companions a clump of daffodils come out before their time, a few primroses, the first in flower, while here and there burned the blue flame of a violet, its stem bent beneath the weight of the drop of perfume stored in its tiny horn. The Pont Vieux led to a towpath, which at this point would be overhung in summer by the bluish foliage of a hazel, under which a fisherman in a straw hat seemed to have taken root. At Combray, where I knew everyone, and could always detect the blacksmith or grocer's boy through his disguise of a beadle's uniform or a chorister's surplice, this fisherman was the only person whom I was never able to identify. He must have known my family, for he used to raise his hat when we passed, and then I would always be just on the point of asking his name when someone would make a sign to me to be quiet or I would frighten the fish. We would follow the towpath which ran along the top of a steep bank several feet above the stream. The ground on the other side was lower and stretched in a series of broad meadows as far as the village and even to the distant railway station. Over these were strewn the remains, half buried in the long grass, of the castle of the old Counts of Combray, who during the Middle Ages had had on this side the course of the Vivonne as a barrier and defence against attack from the lords of Guermantes and abbots of Martinville. Nothing was left now but a few stumps of towers, hummocks upon the broad surface of the fields, hardly visible, broken battlements over which in their day the bowmen had hurled down stones, the watchmen had gazed out over Neuve-Pont, Clairefontaine, Martinville-le-Sec, Bayeux-l'Exempt, fiefs, all of them of Guermantes, a ring in which Combray was locked, but fallen among the grass now, levelled with the ground, climbed and commanded by boys from the Christian Brothers' school, who came there in their playtime or with lesson books to be conned, emblems of a past that had sunk down and well-nigh vanished under the earth, that lay by the water's edge now, like an idler taking the air, yet giving me strong food for thought, making the name of Combray connote to me not the little town of today only, but an historic city, vastly different, seizing and holding my imagination by the remote, incomprehensible features which it half concealed beneath a spangled veil of buttercups. For the buttercups grew past numbering on this spot, which they had chosen for their games among the grass, standing singly, in couples, in whole companies, yellow as the yolk of eggs, and glowing with an added lustre. I felt, because being powerless to consummate with my palate, the pleasure which the sight of them never failed to give me, I would let it accumulate as my eyes ranged over their gilded expanse, until it had acquired the strength to create in my mind a fresh example of absolute, unproductive beauty. And so it had been from my earliest childhood, when from the towpath I had stretched out my arms towards them, before even I could pronounce their charming name, a name fit for the prince in some French fairy tale. Colonists, perhaps, in some far distant century from Asia, but naturalized now for ever in the village, well satisfied with their modest horizon, rejoicing in the sunshine and the water's edge, faithful to their little glimpse of the old railway station, yet keeping nonetheless, as do some of our old paintings, in their plebeian simplicity, a poetic scintillation from the golden east. I would amuse myself by watching the glass jars, which the boys used to lower in the Vivonne to catch minnows, and which, filled by the current of the stream in which they themselves also were enclosed, at once containers whose transparent sides were like solidified water, and contents plunged into a still larger container of liquid, flowing crystal, suggested an image of coolness more delicious and more provoking than the same water in the same jars would have done, standing upon a table laid for dinner, by showing it as perpetually in flight between the impalpable water in which my hands could not arrest it, and the insoluble glass in which my palate could not enjoy it. I decided that I would come there again with a line and catch fish. I begged for and obtained a morsel of bread from our luncheon basket, and threw into the vivon pellets which had the power, it seemed, to bring about a chemical precipitation, for the water at once grew solid round about them in oval clusters of emaciated tadpoles, which until then it had no doubt been holding in solution, invisible but ready and alert to enter the stage of crystallization. Presently the course of the vivon became choked with water plants. At first they appeared singly, a lily, for instance, which the current, across whose path it had unfortunately grown, would never leave at rest for a moment, so that, like a ferry-boat mechanically propelled, it would drift over to one bank only to return to the other, eternally repeating its double journey. Thrust towards the bank, its stalk would be straightened out, lengthened, strained almost to breaking point until the current again caught it, its green moorings swung back over their anchorage and brought the unhappy plant to what might fitly be called its starting point, since it was fated not to rest there a moment before moving off once again. I would still find it there, on one walk after another, always in the same helpless state, suggesting certain victims of neurasthenia, among whom my grandfather would have included my Aunt Leonie, who present without modification, year after year, the spectacle of their odd and unaccountable habits, which they always imagine themselves to be on the point of shaking off, but which they always retain to the end. Caught in the treadmill of their own maladies and eccentricities, their futile endeavours to escape serve only to actuate its mechanism, to keep in motion the clockwork of their strange, ineluctable, fatal daily round. Such as these was the water lily, and also like one of those wretches whose peculiar torments, repeated indefinitely throughout eternity, aroused the curiosity of Dante, who would have inquired of them at greater length and in fuller detail from the victims themselves, had not Virgil, striding on ahead, obliged him to hasten after him at full speed, as I must hasten after my parents. But farther on the current slackened, where the stream ran through a property thrown open to the public by its owner, who had made a hobby of aquatic gardening, so that the little ponds into which the vivon was here diverted were aflower with water lilies. As the banks at this point were thickly wooded, the heavy shade of the trees gave the water a background which was ordinarily dark green, although sometimes when we were coming home on a calm evening after a stormy afternoon, I have seen in its depths a clear, crude blue that was almost violet, suggesting a floor of Japanese cloisonné. Here and there on the surface floated, blushing like a strawberry, the scarlet heart of a lily set in a ring of white petals. Beyond these the flowers were more frequent, but paler, less glossy, more thickly seeded, more tightly folded, and disposed by accident in festoons so graceful that I would fancy I saw floating upon the stream as though after the dreary stripping of the decorations used in some Watteau festival, moss roses in loosened garlands. Elsewhere a corner seemed to be reserved for the commoner kinds of lily, of a neat pink or white like rocket flowers, washed clean like porcelain with housewifely care, while a little farther again were others pressed together in a floating garden bed as though pansies had flown out of a garden like butterflies and were hovering with blue and burnished wings over the transparent shadowiness of this watery border. This sky border also, for it set beneath the flowers a soil of a colour more precious, more moving than their own. And both in the afternoon, when it sparkled beneath the lilies, in the kaleidoscope of a happiness, silent, restless, and alert, and towards evening, when it was filled like a distant heaven with the roseate dreams of the setting sun, incessantly changing and ever remaining in harmony, about the more permanent colour of the flowers themselves, with the utmost profundity, evanescence, and mystery, with a quiet suggestion of infinity, afternoon or evening, it seemed to have set them flowering in the heart of the sky. After leaving this park, the Vivonne began to flow again more swiftly. How often have I watched and longed to imitate, when I should be free to live as I chose, a rower who had shipped his oars and lay stretched out on his back, his head down in the bottom of his boat, letting it drift with the current, seeing nothing but the sky which slipped quietly above him, showing upon his features a foretaste of happiness and peace. We would sit down among the irises at the water's edge. In the holiday sky, a lazy cloud streamed out to its full length. Now and then, crushed by the burden of idleness, a carp would heave up out of the water with an anxious gasp. It was time for us to feed. Before starting homewards, we would sit for a long time there, eating fruit and bread and chocolate on the grass, over which came to our ears, horizontal, faint, but solid still and metallic, the sound of the bells of Saint-Hilaire, which had melted not at all in the atmosphere it was so well accustomed to traverse, but broken piecemeal by the successive palpitation of all their sonorous strokes, throbbed as it brushed the flowers at our feet. Sometimes at the water's edge and embedded in trees, we would come upon a house of the kind called pleasure houses, isolated and lost, seeing nothing of the world save the river which bathed its feet. A young woman whose pensive face and fashionable veils did not suggest a local origin, and who had doubtless come there in the popular phrase, to bury herself, to taste the bitter sweetness of feeling that her name, and still more the name of him whose heart she had once held but had been unable to keep, were unknown there, stood framed in a window from which she had no outlook beyond the boat that was moored beside her door. She raised her eyes with an air of distraction when she heard through the trees that lined the bank the voices of passers-by of whom, before they came in sight, she might be certain that never had they known, nor would they know, the faithless lover, that nothing in their past lives bore his imprint, which nothing in their future would have occasion to receive. One felt that in her renunciation of life, she had willingly abandoned those places in which she would at least have been able to see him whom she loved, for others where he had never trod. And I watched her as she returned from some walk along a road where she had known that he would not appear, drawing from her submissive fingers long gloves of a precious, useless charm. Never, in the course of all our walks along the Guermantes way, might we penetrate as far as the source of the Vivonne, of which I had often thought, which had in my mind so abstract, so ideal an existence, that I had been as much surprised when someone told me that it was actually to be found in the same department and at a given number of miles from Cambrai, as I had been on the day when I had learnt that there was another fixed point somewhere on the earth's surface, where, according to the ancients, opened the jaws of hell. Nor could we ever reach that other goal to which I longed so much to attain, Guermantes itself. I knew that it was the resident of its proprietors, the Duc and Duchesse de Guermantes. I knew that they were real personages who did actually exist, but whenever I thought about them, I pictured them to myself either in tapestry, as was the coronation of Esther which hung in our church, or else in changing rainbow colours, as was Gilbert the Bad in his window, where he passed from cabbage green when I was dipping my fingers in the holy water stoop, to plum blue when I had reached our row of chairs, or again altogether impalpable, like the image of Genevieve de Brabant, ancestress of the Guermantes family, which the magic lantern sent wandering over the curtains of my room or flung aloft upon the ceiling. In short, always wrapped in the mystery of the Merovingian age and bathed, as in a sunset, in the orange light which glowed from the resounding syllable, Aunt. And if, in spite of that, they were for me in their capacity as a duke and duchess real people, though of an unfamiliar kind, this ducal personality was in its turn enormously distended, immaterialized, so as to encircle and contain that Guermantes of which they were duke and duchess, all that sunlit Guermantes way of our walks, the course of the Vivonne, its water lilies and its overshadowing trees, and an endless series of hot summer afternoons. And I knew that they bore not only the titles of Duke and Duchesse de Guermantes, but that since the 14th century, when, after vain attempts to conquer its earlier lords in battle, they had allied themselves by marriage and so became Counts of Cambrai, the first citizens, consequently, of the place, and yet the only ones among its citizens who did not reside in it. Comte de Cambrai, possessing Cambrai, threading it on their string of names and titles, absorbing it in their personalities, and illustrating, no doubt, in themselves that strange and pious melancholy which was peculiar to Cambrai. Proprietors of the town, though not of any particular house there, dwelling presumably out of doors, in the street, between heaven and earth, like that Gilbert de Guermantes, of whom I could see in the stained glass of the apse of Saint-Hilaire only the other side in dull black lacquer, if I raised my eyes to look for him when I was going to Camus for a packet of salt. And then it happened that, going the Guermantes way, I passed occasionally by a row of well-watered little gardens, over whose hedges rose clusters of dark blossom. I would stop before them, hoping to gain some precious addition to my experience, for I seemed to have before my eyes a fragment of that riverside country which I had longed so much to see and know since coming upon a description of it by one of my favourite authors. And it was with that storybook land, with its imagined soil intersected by 100 bubbling watercourses, that Guermantes, changing its form in my mind, became identified, after I heard Dr. Percepied speak of the flowers and the charming rivulets and fountains that were to be seen there in the ducal park. I used to dream that Madame de Guermantes, taking a sudden capricious fancy for myself, invited me there, that all day long she stood fishing for trout by my side, and when evening came, holding my hand in her own, as we passed by the little gardens of her vassals, she would point out to me the flowers that leaned their red and purple spikes along the tops of the low walls, and would teach me all their names. She would make me tell her, too, all about the poems that I meant to compose. And these dreams reminded me that, since I wished some day to become a writer, it was high time to decide what sort of books I was going to write. But as soon as I asked myself the question, and tried to discover some subject to which I could impart a philosophical significance of infinite value, my mind would stop like a clock. I would see before me vacuity, nothing, would feel either that I was wholly devoid of talent, or that perhaps a malady of the brain was hindering its development. Sometimes I would depend upon my father's arranging everything for me. He was so powerful, in such favour with the people who really counted, that he made it possible for us to transgress laws which Françoise had taught me to regard as more ineluctable than the laws of life and death, as when we were allowed to postpone for a year the compulsory repainting of the walls of our house, alone among all the houses in that part of Paris, or when he obtained permission from the minister for Madame Sazerat's son, who had been ordered to some watering place, to take his degree 2 months before the proper time, among the candidates whose surnames began with A, instead of having to wait his turn as an S. If I had fallen seriously ill, if I had been captured by brigands, convinced that my father's understanding with the supreme powers was too complete, that his letters of introduction to the Almighty were too irresistible for my illness or captivity to turn out anything but vain illusions in which there was no danger actually threatening me, I should have awaited with perfect composure the inevitable hour of my return to comfortable realities, of my deliverance from bondage or restoration to health. Perhaps this want of talent, this black cavity which gaped in my mind when I ransacked it for the theme of my future writings, was itself no more either than an unsubstantial illusion, and would be brought to an end by the intervention of my father, who would arrange with the government and with Providence that I should be the first writer of my day. But at other times, while my parents were growing impatient at seeing me loiter behind instead of following them, my actual life, instead of seeming an artificial creation by my father, and one which he could modify as he chose, appeared, on the contrary, to be comprised in a larger reality which had not been created for my benefit, from whose judgments there was no appeal, in the heart of which I was bound helpless without friend or ally, and beyond which no further possibilities lay concealed. It was evident to me then that I existed in the same manner as all other men, that I must grow old, that I must die like them, and that among them I was to be distinguished merely as one of those who have no aptitude for writing. And so, utterly despondent, I renounced literature for ever, despite the encouragements that had been given me by Bloch. This intimate, spontaneous feeling, this sense of the nullity of my intellect, prevailed against all the flattering speeches that might be lavished upon me, as a wicked man, when everyone is loud in the praise of his good deeds, is gnawed by the secret remorse of conscience. One day my mother said, "You are always talking about Madame de Guermantes. Well, Dr. Percepied did a great deal for her when she was ill 4 years ago, and so she is coming to Cambrai for his daughter's wedding. You will be able to see her in church." It was from Dr. Percepied, as it happened, that I had heard most about Madame de Guermantes, and he had even shown us the number of an illustrated paper in which she was depicted in the costume which she had worn at a fancy dress ball given by the Princesse de Léon. Suddenly, during the nuptial mass, the beadle, by moving to one side, enabled me to see, sitting in a chapel, a lady with fair hair and a large nose, piercing blue eyes, a billowy scarf of mauve silk, glossy and new and brilliant, and a little spot at the corner of her nose. And because on the surface of her face, which was red, as though she had been very warm, I could make out, diluted and barely perceptible, details which resembled the portrait that had been shown to me, because, more especially, the particular features which I remarked in this lady, if I attempted to catalogue them, formulated themselves in precisely the same terms, a large nose, blue eyes, as Dr. Percepied had used when describing in my presence the Duchesse de Guermantes, I said to myself, "This lady is like the Duchesse de Guermantes." Now the chapel from which she was following the service was that of Gilbert the Bad, Beneath its flat tombstones, yellowed and bulging like cells of honey in a comb, rested the bones of the old Counts of Brabant. And I remembered having heard it said that this chapel was reserved for the Guermantes family whenever any of its members came to attend a ceremony at Cambrai. There was, indeed, but one woman resembling the portrait of Madame de Guermantes, who on that day, the very day on which she was expected to come there, could be sitting in that chapel. It was she. My disappointment was immense. It arose from my not having borne in mind, when I thought of Madame de Guermantes, that I was picturing her to myself in the colours of a tapestry or a painted window, as living in another century, as being of another substance than the rest of the human race. Never had I taken into account that she might have a red face, a mauve scarf like Madame Sazerat, and the oval curve of her cheeks reminded me so strongly of people whom I had seen at home that the suspicion brushed against my mind, though it was immediately banished, that this lady in her creative principle, in the molecules of her physical composition, was perhaps not substantially the Duchesse de Guermantes, but that her body, in ignorance of the name that people had given it, belonged to a certain type of femininity which included also the wives of doctors and tradesmen. It is, it must be, Madame de Guermantes, and no one else, were the words underlying the attentive and astonished expression with which I was gazing upon this image, which, naturally enough, bore no resemblance to those that had so often, under the same title of Madame de Guermantes, appeared to me in dreams, since this one had not been like the others, formed arbitrarily by myself, but had sprung into sight for the first time only a moment ago, here in church. An image which was not of the same nature, was not colourable at will, like those others that allowed themselves to imbibe the orange tint of a sonorous syllable, but which was so real that everything, even to the fiery little spot at the corner of her nose, gave an assurance of her subjection to the laws of life. As, in a transformation scene on the stage, a crease in the dress of a fairy, a quivering of her tiny finger, indicate the material presence of a living actress before our eyes, whereas we were uncertain till then whether we were not looking merely at a projection of limelight from a lantern. Meanwhile, I was endeavouring to apply to this image, which the prominent nose, the piercing eyes pinned down and fixed in my field of vision, perhaps because it was they that had first struck it, that had made the first impression on its surface, before I had had time to wonder whether the woman who thus appeared before me might possibly be Madame de Guermantes. To this fresh and unchanging image, the idea, it is Madame de Guermantes. But I succeeded only in making the idea pass between me and the image, as though they were two discs moving in separate planes, with a space between. But this Madame de Guermantes, of whom I had so often dreamed, now that I could see that she had a real existence, independent of myself, acquired a fresh increase of power over my imagination, which, paralysed for a moment by contact with a reality so different from anything that it had expected, began to react and to say within me, "Great and glorious before the days of Charlemagne, the Guermantes had the right of life and death over their vassals. The Duchesse de Guermantes descends from Geneviève de Brabant. She does not know, nor would she consent to know, any of the people who are here today." And then, oh, marvellous independence of the human gaze, tied to the human face by a cord so loose, so long, so elastic, that it can stray alone as far as it may choose, while Madame de Guermantes sat in the chapel above the tombs of her dead ancestors, her gaze lingered here and wandered there, rose to the capitals of the pillars, and even rested upon myself like a ray of sunlight straying down the nave. But a ray of sunlight which, at the moment when I received its caress, appeared conscious of where it fell. As for Madame de Guermantes herself, since she remained there motionless, sitting like a mother who affects not to notice the rude or awkward conduct of her children, who in the course of their play are speaking to people whom she does not know, it was impossible for me to determine whether she approved or condemned the vagrancy of her eyes in the careless detachment of her heart. I felt it to be important that she should not leave the church before I had been able to look long enough upon her, reminding myself that for years past I had regarded the sight of her as a thing eminently to be desired, and I kept my eyes fixed on her, as though by gazing at her I should be able to carry away and incorporate, to store up for later reference in myself, the memory of that prominent nose, those red cheeks, of all those details which struck me as so much precious, authentic, unparalleled information with regard to her face. And now that, whenever I brought my mind to bear upon that face, and especially perhaps in my determination, that form of instinct of self-preservation with which we guard everything that is best in ourselves, not to admit that I had been in any way deceived, I found only beauty there. Setting her once again, since they were one and the same person, this lady who sat before me, and that Duchesse de Guermantes, whom, until then, I had been used to conjure into an imagined shape, apart from and above that common run of humanity, with which the sight, pure and simple, of her in the flesh had made me for a moment confound her. I grew indignant when I heard people saying in the congregation around me, "She is better looking than Madame Sazerat or than Mademoiselle Vinteuil," as though she had been in any way comparable with them. And my gaze resting upon her fair hair, her blue eyes, the lines of her neck, and overlooking the features which might have reminded me of the faces of other women, I cried out within myself as I admired this deliberately unfinished sketch, "How lovely she is! What true nobility! It is indeed a proud Guermantes, the descendant of Geneviève de Brabant, that I have before me." And the care which I took to focus all my attention upon her face succeeded in isolating it so completely that today, when I call that marriage ceremony to mind, I find it impossible to visualize any single person who was present except her, and the beadle who answered me in the affirmative when I inquired whether the lady was, indeed, Madame de Guermantes. But her, I can see her still quite clearly, especially at the moment when the procession filed into the sacristy, lighted by the intermittent hot sunshine of a windy and rainy day, where Madame de Guermantes found herself in the midst of all those Cambrai people, whose names even she did not know, but whose inferiority proclaimed her own supremacy so loud that she must in return feel for them a genuine, pitying sympathy, and whom she might count on impressing even more forcibly by virtue of her simplicity and natural charm. And then, too, since she could not bring into play the deliberate glances, charged with a definite meaning, which one directs in a crowd towards people whom one knows, but must allow her vague thoughts to escape continually from their eyes in a flood of blue light which she was powerless to control, she was anxious not to distress in any way, not to seem to be despising those humbler mortals over whom that current flowed, by whom it was everywhere arrested. I can see again today, above her mauve scarf, silky and buoyant, the gentle astonishment in her eyes, to which she had added, without daring to address it to anyone in particular, but so that everyone might enjoy his share of it, the almost timid smile of a sovereign lady who seems to be making an apology for her presence among the vassals whom she loves. This smile rested upon myself, who had never ceased to follow her with my eyes, and I, Remembering the glance which she had let fall upon me during the service, blue as a ray of sunlight that had penetrated the window of Gilbert the Bad, said to myself, "Of course, she is thinking about me." I fancied that I had found favour in her sight, that she would continue to think of me after she had left the church, and would perhaps grow pensive again that evening at Guermantes on my account. And at once I fell in love with her. For if it is sometimes enough to make us love a woman that she looks on us with contempt, as I suppose Mademoiselle Swann to have done, while we imagine that she cannot ever be ours, it is enough also sometimes that she looks on us kindly, as Madame de Guermantes did then, while we think of her as almost ours already. Her eyes waxed blue as a periwinkle flower, wholly beyond my reach, yet dedicated by her to me. And the sun, bursting out again from behind a threatening cloud, and darting the full force of its rays onto the square and into the sacristy, shed a geranium glow over the red carpet laid down for the wedding, along which Madame de Guermantes smilingly advanced and covered its woollen texture with a nap of rosy velvet, a bloom of light, giving it that sort of tenderness, of solemn sweetness, in the pomp of a joyful celebration, which characterizes certain pages of Lohengrin, certain paintings by Carpaccio, and makes us understand how Baudelaire was able to apply to the sound of the trumpet the epithet delicious. How often after that day, in the course of my walks along the Guermantes way, and with what an intensified melancholy did I reflect on my lack of qualification for a literary career, and that I must abandon all hope of ever becoming a famous author. The regret that I felt for this, while I lingered alone to dream for a little by myself, made me suffer so acutely that in order not to feel it, my mind of its own accord, by a sort of inhibition in the instant of pain, ceased entirely to think of verse-making, of fiction, of the poetic future on which my want of talent precluded me from counting. Then, quite apart from all those literary preoccupations, and without definite attachment to anything, suddenly a roof, a gleam of sunlight reflected from a stone, the smell of a road, would make me stop still to enjoy the special pleasure that each of them gave me. And also because they appeared to be concealing, beneath what my eyes could see, something which they invited me to approach and seize from them, but which, despite all my efforts, I never managed to discover. As I felt that the mysterious object was to be found in them, I would stand there in front of them, motionless, gazing, breathing, endeavouring to penetrate with my mind beyond the thing seen or smelt. And if I had then to hasten after my grandfather to proceed on my way, I would still seek to recover my sense of them by closing my eyes. I would concentrate upon recalling exactly the line of the roof, the colour of the stone, which, without my being able to understand why, had seemed to me to be teeming, ready to open, to yield up to me the secret treasure of which they were themselves no more than the outer coverings. It was certainly not any impression of this kind that could or would restore the hope I had lost of succeeding one day in becoming an author and poet, for each of them was associated with some material object, devoid of any intellectual value, and suggesting no abstract truth. But at least they gave me an unreasoning pleasure, the illusion of a sort of fecundity of mind, and in that way distracted me from the tedium, from the sense of my own impotence which I had felt whenever I had sought a philosophic theme for some great literary work. So urgent was the task imposed on my conscience by these impressions of form or perfume or colour, to strive for a perception of what lay hidden beneath them, that I was never long in seeking an excuse which would allow me to relax so strenuous an effort, and to spare myself the fatigue that it involved. As good luck would have it, my parents called me. I felt that I had not, for the moment, the calm environment necessary for a successful pursuit of my researches, and that it would be better to think no more of the matter until I reached home, and not to exhaust myself in the meantime to no purpose. And so I concerned myself no longer with the mystery that lay hidden in a form or a perfume, quite at ease in my mind, since I was taking it home with me, protected by its visible and tangible covering, beneath which I should find it still alive, like the fish which on days when I had been allowed to go out fishing I used to carry back in my basket, buried in a couch of grass which kept them cool and fresh. Once in the house again, I would begin to think of something else, and so my mind would become littered, as my room was, with the flowers that I had gathered on my walks, or the odds and ends that people had given me, with a stone from the surface of which the sunlight was reflected, a roof, the sound of a bell, the smell of fallen leaves, a confused mass of different images, under which must have perished long ago the reality of which I used to have some foreboding, but which I never had the energy to discover and bring to light. Once, however, when we had prolonged our walk far beyond its ordinary limits, and so had been very glad to encounter halfway home, as afternoon darkened into evening, Dr. Percepied, who drove past us at full speed in his carriage, saw and recognized us, stopped and made us jump in beside him. I received an impression of this sort which I did not abandon without having first subjected it to an examination a little more thorough. I had been set on the box beside the coachman. We were going like the wind, because the doctor had still, before returning to Cambrai, to call at Martainville-le-Sec at the house of a patient, at whose door he asked us to wait for him. At a bend in the road, I experienced suddenly that special pleasure, which bore no resemblance to any other, when I caught sight of the twin steeples of Martainville, on which the setting sun was playing, while the movement of the carriage and the windings of the road seemed to keep them continually changing their position, and then of a third steeple, that of Vieux-Vic, which, although separated from them by a hill and a valley, and rising from rather higher ground in the distance, appeared nonetheless to be standing by their side. In ascertaining and noting the shape of their spires, the change of aspect, the sunny warmth of their surfaces, I felt that I was not penetrating to the full depth of my impression, that something more lay behind that mobility, that luminosity, something which they seemed at once to contain and to conceal. The steeples appeared so distant, and we ourselves seemed to come so little nearer them, that I was astonished when, a few minutes later, we drew up outside the church at Martainville. I did not know the reason for the pleasure which I had found in seeing them upon the horizon, and the business of trying to find out what that reason was seemed to me irksome. I wished only to keep in reserve in my brain those converging lines moving in the sunshine, and for the time being to think of them no more. And it is probable that had I done so, those two steeples would have vanished forever in a great medley of trees and roofs and scents and sounds which I had noticed and set apart on account of the obscure sense of pleasure which they gave me, but without ever exploring them more fully. I got down from the box to talk to my parents while we were waiting for the doctor to reappear. Then it was time to start. I climbed up again to my place, turning my head to look back once more at my steeples, of which a little later I caught a farewell glimpse at a turn in the road. The coachman, who seemed little inclined for conversation, having barely acknowledged my remarks, I was obliged, in default of other society, to fall back on my own, and to attempt to recapture the vision of my steeples. And presently their outlines and their sunlit surface, as though they had been a sort of rind, were stripped apart. A little of what they had concealed from me became apparent. An idea came into my mind which had not existed for me a moment earlier,
framed itself in words in my head, and the pleasure with which the first sight of them just now had filled me was so much enhanced that, overpowered by a sort of intoxication, I could no longer think of anything but them. At this point, although we had now travelled a long way from Martinville, I turned my head and caught sight of them again, quite black this time, for the sun had meanwhile set. Every few minutes a turn in the road would sweep them out of sight. Then they showed themselves for the last time, and so I saw them no more. Without admitting to myself that what lay buried within the steeples of Martinville must be something analogous to a charming phrase, since it was in the form of words which gave me pleasure that it had appeared to me, I borrowed a pencil and some paper from the doctor, and composed, in spite of the jolting of the carriage, to appease my conscience and to satisfy my enthusiasm, the following little fragment, which I have since discovered and now reproduce with only a slight revision here and there. Alone, rising from the level of the plain, and seemingly lost in that expanse of open country, climbed to the sky the twin steeples of Martinville. Presently, we saw three, springing into position, confronting them by a daring vault. A third, a dilatory steeple, that of Vieux-Vic, was coming to join them. The minutes passed. We were moving rapidly, and yet the three steeples were always a long way ahead of us, like three birds perched upon the plain, motionless and conspicuous in the sunlight. Then the steeple of Vieux-Vic withdrew, took its proper distance, and the steeples of Martinville remained alone, gilded by the light of the setting sun, which, even at that distance, I could see playing and smiling upon their sloped sides. We had been so long in approaching them that I was thinking of the time that must still elapse before we could reach them, when, of a sudden, the carriage, having turned a corner, set us down at their feet. And they had flung themselves so abruptly in our path that we had barely time to stop before being dashed against the porch of the church. We resumed our course. We had left Martinville some little time, and the village, after accompanying us for a few seconds, had already disappeared, when, lingering alone on the horizon to watch our flight, its steeples and that of Vieux-Vic waved once again, in token of farewell, their sun-bathed pinnacles. Sometimes one would withdraw, so that the other two might watch us for a moment still. Then the road changed direction, they veered in the light like three golden pivots, and vanished from my gaze. But a little later, when we were already close to Cambrai, the sun having set meanwhile, I caught sight of them for the last time, far away, and seeming no more now than three flowers painted upon the sky above the low line of fields. They made me think, too, of three maidens in a legend, abandoned in a solitary place over which night had begun to fall. And while we drew away from them at a gallop, I could see them timidly seeking their way, and after some awkward, stumbling movements of their noble silhouettes, drawing close to one another, slipping one behind the other, showing nothing more now against the still rosy sky than a single dusky form, charming and resigned, and so vanishing in the night.